The woman was injured when she was picked up and slammed down onto a station bench by two officers, and then was charged with a crime that portrayed her as the aggressor. Records from the Internal Affairs investigation were filed in U.S. District Court Friday, stating, quote, "This use of force was excessive." Last month, McCracken was charged with intentionally violating an unrelated order of protection involving his estranged wife.
Politico reported that after nearly 5 years of investigations by at least four state and federal entities and a year of courtroom proceedings, a series of probes into how Niagara County Republicans sent campaign money has ended with a $1,000 fine. Former State Senator George Mazieras pleaded guilty to one misdemeanor in an Albany County courthouse Friday afternoon. Mazieras admitted that he concealed $95,000 in payments to a former staffer who left his job amid sexual harassment allegations.
The U.S. Senate is preparing to scale back the sweeping banking regulations passed after the 2008 financial crisis. More than a dozen Democrats are ready to give Republicans the votes they need to weaken one of President Barack Obama's largest legislative achievements. However, the leading Senate contenders for the Democratic nomination for president are all expected to vote against the measure, as party activists want a candidate who will stand up to Wall Street.
Shell Shivashi Farley, a private equity executive and Republican Party fundraiser, was chosen Friday by New York State GOP leaders to challenge Democratic U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand in this fall's election. Farley, who earned an engineering degree from Stanford University, criticized what she called Gillibrand's extreme liberalism and said that the senator hasn't done enough to get New York the funding it needs to repair its roads, bridges, and other infrastructure. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. You can also text us at 518-888-3004. That's 518-888-3004. On Tuesday, Steven Strykman, the Troy Commissioner of Planning, gave a presentation and fielded questions from Hillside residents. If you're in South Troy, there is another sessioning happening right now at the Troy Italian Community Center that started at 6 o'clock. But now let's hear from last Tuesday's session.
So here are the six goals that I talked about before. So the first one is growing the economy. And I'm just going to read you the major bullets there. So these are the things that are talked about in the plan, which is basically promoting the city center as a key area for residential growth, promoting job growth and competitiveness of the city's existing employment base, and then there's a bunch of bullets on how this is all going to happen. Supporting existing and new creative and cultural industries, promoting tourism, and enhancing and supporting education and workforce training to maintain a strong position in the knowledge economy. And one of Stephanie's comments the other night was there's not a lot in here about education in the school system. It talks about job readiness, but it really doesn't talk about the school system. So we're going to look at that and figure out. And if you have any specific comments you want to give me, what do you think it should say, let me know. Okay? Because I don't want to be the one writing that. And then this was the employment areas that we talked about, I talked a little bit about before. So goal two is promote healthy, safe, and green neighborhoods. And first there's some generic ones. Leverage the livability and safety of Troy's neighborhoods. Encourage a diverse housing stock to meet the needs of Troy's existing and future population. Support long-term neighborhood reinvestment through rehabilitation of Troy's older and vacant housing stock. Ensure Troy's neighborhoods are healthy, active communities, and provide accessible housing options. And this might not be a bad place to even look at adding something in about protecting the character. I know everybody's up in arms about student housing and that's impact in this area. And it's hard to control, but I think we need to continue to look for ways to be able to do something. Again, it's tough. We've been kind of prohibited from doing a lot of that with zoning. Okay, So this is where it breaks into the neighborhood pieces. So there's a section on Lansingburg. There's a section on North Central, which includes Hillside North. And so I presented this at Hillside North last week. There wasn't a lot of feedback or comments for changes, but again, we'll still take accepting any comments. And then Hillside, which includes Beeman Park, RPI, Congress Street, and Sycaway. And I know it doesn't, you know, I know you don't really consider Sycaway your neighborhood, but it's in here. It shares Hoosick Street with you. So, strategies for Hillside: implement the following recommendations from the Hoosick Street corridor plan. Redesign Hoosick Street as a parkway with median reduced access points and trees. And again, these are already, all these here are from the existing Hoosick Street plan. Enforce the land use regulations adopted in the zoning ordinance, which we don't always do too good. Develop neighborhood design guidelines to ensure future development renovations create a consistent, coherent, and functional district. Construct a western gateway at the bridge and an eastern gateway at the Mount Pleasant Avenue. Create an access management plan to consolidate and eliminate and regulate driveways and identify bicycle routes and trail opportunities. We are in the running for a follow-up study to that grant, which will look at Hillside and Hillside North. And I think it looks pretty good to get that. And it'll look at how to connect these two neighborhoods to downtown better across 6th Avenue, finding additional ways to get down there, how to protect the streets, looking at, you know, the speeding and all the conditions that people complain about, the cut-through traffic. So that'll be the next phase of that, and hopefully being able to do something with the intersections at least of 8th, 9th, and 10th with Hoosick Street, and maybe even the approach in from the bridge. Again, I think the whole Hoosick Street corridor is kind of its own little nightmare that I think DOT is going to need to come in with $20 million before. It's certainly not something Troy's going to be able to do without, but I think the more we can put together, the more we can advocate for changes in the future. The 2004 study calls for development on Hoosick Street to take advantage of all the traffic. So it doesn't say don't do anything there, but I don't think it's all happened quite the way it's supposed to happen. The McDonald's obviously was not the way it was supposed to happen. So I think we need to... What was that? You're right, yeah. And it gets tough because you got grandfathered businesses, you want to see them improve, so how do you deal with like Stewart's? And that, you know. Yet Stewart's, the plan talked about a bigger location, a bigger redeveloped Stewart's site. So and using the lots behind them. So that's what they did. The problem is they're not gonna build a Stewart's out to the street. And I don't know if you're ever really going to build buildings to the street on Hoosick Street as the plan says. Let's see. Enhance existing parks and natural spaces while encouraging the development of new open spaces, including pocket parks. This gets a little specific. Beeman Park, creation of a dog park and new playground equipment. 9th Street Park, new playground equipment. 8th Street Park, tree planting and landscaping initiatives. Prospect Park, resurfacing of the existing tennis court, enhancements to the conditions of the... I was reading it wrong. Enhancements to the condition of the spray park. I'm sorry. Adaptive reuse of the pool into a skateboard park or theater. Introduce that's Prospect Park. And then introduce pedestrian-scale lighting along key neighborhood routes to promote passive surveillance and enhance safety. Consider introducing traffic calming measures in the neighborhoods, such as speed tables and bump outs to reduce speeds. Consider the introduction of raised barriers or other interventions that eliminate cut-through traffic and prohibit heavy truck traffic within the neighborhood. And if we get the money for the study, you can at that time come out and say if you want to do that or not. Repair and maintain the approach at 12th Street and People's Avenue, the little approach. Inventory sidewalk conditions throughout the neighborhood and develop a long-term plan to complete the sidewalk network. Enhance the intersection of Sage and Eaton Road to improve access and safety for pedestrians and cyclists. Develop a block master plan to improve the 15th Street between Hoosick and Peoples to create a gateway to the neighborhood into RPI. It should identify the following new streets and path connections that will improve permeability, recommend facade enhancements to commercial and residential buildings to improve the look and feel of the neighborhood, propose locations for open spaces and their relationship to surrounding streets, and then encourage RPI to limit land banking and support the active use of neighborhood properties. So that, in a nutshell, is what we got at our public meeting. And if there's more that you think isn't in there and you want to have it in there, I would say, get me comments. You can tell me tonight. You can tell me tonight and I'll write them down, but it's awfully nice if somebody put their actual wording that they wanted down and got it to me that way instead of giving me a theme and having me write it up for you. Sure. Well, you can go to the website and there'll be a connection. So there should be a connection there. If it's not there tomorrow, it'll be up within a day or two. My email is Stephen with a V. And then it's dot Strikeman, which is not spelled how it's pronounced. STRICHMAN at TroyNY.gov. And it may take me a little bit to get back to you. Okay. I ignore him. No, I don't know. Well, at this point, I guess I would get back to. I mean, sometimes I get suggestions that are okay. We're not looking at something that detailed, so I'll usually email back and set up a meeting to talk to somebody. If that's the case. Sometimes it's not for your neighborhood; it's for the whole plan. So it might not go in this neighborhood. It might go back at the beginning of those bullets and be added in there. Yes. And I'm not taking any notes right now, okay? I'm listening to everything, so please follow up with me if you have something. Yes.
What's a community development grant?
That's federal funding. So there's every year the city gets 2 point something, I don't know what the number is, from HUD. And that's for certain areas that are targeted neighborhoods, usually the high poverty, high unemployment. There's a number of things that make them. It's pretty much all of downtown, with one exception between Lansingburg and North Central. Less so on the Hill, but I think Hillside, I think this is an area that's in it as well.
That was Troy Commissioner of Planning, Stephen Strikeman, presenting a draft comprehensive plan for the City of Troy. A follow-up meeting is happening as we speak at the Italian Community Center. Next Monday night at 6 p.m. will be the downtown meeting at St. Paul's Church Guidehouse. You can learn more about the draft comprehensive plan by visiting realizetroy.com.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. WOOC correspondent Jonah Moberg met with Connor Ambruster and Jack Levine at the Adirondack Whaling Company, a Troy-based band and multimedia experiment whose work combines fantasy and catharsis to explore the beauty and alienation of upstate New York. We'll hear them talk about their work, and then we'll hear the radio premiere of their latest track. I'm Connor Ambruster.
I'm Jack Levine.
And collectively?
And collectively, we are two-thirds of the Adirondack Whaling Company. Which I just said at the same time. Our third member, Alex, is not here, and he also performs under the name Hunt.
I think he pronounces it like Hunter.
But his Twitter name is HNT Hunt.
So what brought you all together musically?
Well, Jack and I went to high school together, and we had pretty similar interests, and both of us were involved. I think really the thing that kicked us off musically was we were in this production of Twelfth Night, where he was playing Feste, and I was like writing the music, and we had this little chamber group, and it was all like the whole play was presented in this like psychedelic Beatles 1960s style. So we did all these Beatles covers and stuff, and Feste was like singing in some of the songs and everything. So yeah.
Cool.
That was like the beginning
so bizarre.
Of our. It makes a lot of sense, though. I think that
the Twelfth Night thing makes sense, knowing a bit of your music, just the whole like fantastical and kind of literary quality to what you do.
Yeah.
Could you talk about the premise of the group Adirondack Whaling Company?
Yes. So it's gone through multiple iterations, but it's definitely very story-based, and we've always tried to make it not really just music, but sort of like a whole collective mythology. So we came up with, we were like thinking of names for a group, and we knew we wanted to have a story. And I'm not exactly sure how Adirondack Whaling Company started, but somebody came up with the name, and then we developed a story around that, which was also loosely based off of a scene of Fantasia 2000.
I think the main goal is, I think we talked about our like aesthetic appreciation for some of that music, especially that one Fantasia thing with the whales flying. And there's an alienating aspect to that, right? Combining something that you know is not connected to the ocean, but putting whales there. And I think that was the idea, is just let's try to talk about the things that we're interested in, but from a perspective that is just like othered by default, because that'll lead us to ideas that are way different than what we would have ever expected.
Do you think that distance from like reality, you know, makes it easier for you to write vulnerably?
Yes. I have a very hard time. I have a very hard time being honest with myself. I have a very hard time writing lyrics that I feel are honest. And with that detachment, I feel like I'm able to come around to myself. I think that even writing music, like recording structure, figuring out what instruments we want to use, like there's a phrase that was coined, I believe, by a philosopher and history buff named Dan Carlin. He's got a podcast that's called Hardcore History. But he has a term called Martian Americana, or looking at things from a Martian American perspective. Like if you were an alien coming to Earth and you were to view America as it is now, and he's thinking politically, socially, culturally. But a lot of like the movement where we've moved our aesthetic is towards that idea. Detach yourself, but also make yourself completely relevant to what you want to do.
Yeah, and I think it's something too that the way that it's evolved has gone sort of from like we started out as being this band, but then we were coming up with all these ideas from different sources, and it's definitely non-traditional in a sense, because like we go about things in such a bizarre way. Like Jack and I were both pulling ropes for Peter Pan at our middle school last month.
Peter Pan Jr.
Peter Pan Jr. was being performed, and we were flying Peter Pan, and that
I flew Peter Pan.
You flew Peter Pan, and I flew John.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we were there at these rehearsals, and we started looking at Peter Pan, and we tried to like take the most Martian perspective of Peter Pan that we possibly could. And we came up with there's a whole plot in the works, and we're going to make a Captain Hook rock opera.
Well, someone had to.
Yeah.
Wow. And that, I guess that like multiplicity of inspiration that you all share takes forms outside of music. Am I correct? There's a visual aspect to what you do as a band.
Yeah, very much so. I think it's pretty much shared between the two of us. I think that I went in with a lot more of the like, you know, wanting to do watercolor, wanting to do aspects of the world that I was looking at, which was, I mean, at the time, suburban Del Mar, New York, right where I lived and went to school. And then I think you also started to put more attention into your doodles and your drawings. And I think we both kind of discovered this similar visual aesthetic. Which really comes into play with the music video that you recently finished.
I worked on my last semester at RPI. I worked on this like a stop motion, kind of a weird stop motion video that goes along with a song that we recorded last year, and it's like a whole kind of style. Like I made a technique around doing this weird sort of stop motion stuff where I was like finger painting and stuff, and like taking my hands out of frame, and I would set it to automatically take pictures every like couple of seconds, and it was an interesting little thing, but it fits us pretty well. Yeah.
Well, the song itself is it's basically taking that Martian American perspective, and it is the heart of our album that's currently being mastered and going to come out within the next few months. but it's called Sun in the Sky, and it does evoke and talk about the idea of American heartland, which is the title of the album. In that, I think there is so much alienation, and in that, the concept of like being under one umbrella of a nation, of a country, of a, you know, of a people, there are so many of us that walk around and feel as if we're disconnected from the people on the street, from our families, from tradition, from culture. It's all seemed to kind of be, in a way, washed out.
Yeah. You're the Martian American thing, and that idea about alienation reminds me of this quote from William Burroughs, where he said that communicating with extraterrestrials would be just as difficult as communicating with anybody.
So true. It's so true, and it's hard. I mean, you see all sorts of people who have been radicalized in some various way and go on to do some terrible thing to their school, to their church. And I think one of the things at the heart of that issue is a loss of tradition, is a loss of culture, is a loss of connection to community.
Separation, alienation, yeah.
So if people want to get, we only have a couple minutes left, and I would like to fill that with your music. But before that, if people want to hear your music or see your music video or maybe see you play, where can they go to find out about that?
Yeah, so on Apple Music and Bandcamp, and we have a YouTube channel as well.
And you can look it up under Adirondack Whaling Company.
Any gigs coming up?
Upcoming gigs we're playing O Slattery's in Del Mar on March 24th.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jonah.
Thank you.
Dirty lies, dirty lies, dirty lies, dirty lies, dirty lies.
For those just tuning in, I'm Dan Pfeiffer.
And I'm Tatiana Morani. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy. That was the Adirondack Dwelling Company, a track from their upcoming record. You can check out the music video on YouTube or follow them on Facebook and Bandcamp for updates. If you are digging this program, send us a text and let us know. It's 518-888-304. Oop, that's wrong. 518-888-3004.
You can hear more about the Hudson Mohawk program, listen online, and donate to the Sanctuary for Independent Media on our website, mediasanctuary.org.
On Wednesday of this week, Tech Valley Center of Gravity will be hosting an event entitled The Business of Digital Games, Understanding the Business of the Industry. WOOC correspondent Aaron Pettinati recently sat down with Holly Cargill Kramer, the director of Tech Valley Center of Gravity, to discuss that event.
I'm Aaron Pettinati, and today I'm interviewing Holly Cargill Kramer about an event on the business of digital games that is going to be held at Tech Valley Center of Gravity in Troy on Wednesday. Holly is the executive director of Tech Valley Center of Gravity, a makerspace, business incubator, prototyping center, and creative community located in the heart of downtown Troy, New York. She has over 25 years of executive-level service in not-for-profit management and communications with a focus on membership organizations, professional and trade associations, and higher education. As executive director of Tech Valley Center of Gravity, she serves as chief executive and operations officer, overseeing day-to-day operations, fiscal management, and membership recruitment and retention and governance. Holly, thanks very much for taking the time to sit down with me today. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Aaron. Happy to be here.
So to start out, can you tell us about the event that's going to be held this Wednesday? The title is The Business of Digital Games, Understanding the Business of the Industry. In what ways is the event going to address these topics?
Well, just to back up a little bit and talk about why we're even holding the event, we've had a number of other events regionally in recent months, including a meeting that Economic Development Chair Howard Zemsky, or Commissioner Howard Zemsky, held here in Troy, the Small Business Summit that the City of Troy held, and a few other events that have really indicated that there's clearly a cluster growing of digital game businesses in the region, and specifically in Troy. One of the things that I kept hearing at those events was from the design or from the game studio owners, was that they really had a need for a pipeline to the kind of talent that they needed to build the industry in the region. In order for that industry to continue to grow, there needed to be a better pipeline towards that talent. And I think that the talent is there here in the region, but sometimes we don't know what each other need. And that without that understanding of what that pipeline needs to have in it, it's going to be a little emptier. So we decided, working with Ben Chang up at RPI with the New York State Digital Game Hub grant that RPI administers, that there was a need for something that was really connected to the business of game design, not just hackathons and teaching the skills of coding and things like that for digital games, but also to really enhance awareness of the other things that were needed for the industry. So we decided to focus an event on the business of digital games with the idea of helping people understand what skills and talents are needed in the industry and what kinds of employees or contractors are needed in the industry. I think often game developers will hire on and ramp up and hire on consultants and freelancers as they build up towards a launch, and then they'll be either layoffs or the contracts will end and whatnot. So there's a gig economy there that a lot of people don't understand and know about either. So we ended up partnering with the Upstate Alliance for a Creative Economy on the event as well, to bring freelancers in the music and art and event and, you know, all kinds of different freelance and creative people into the event as well to really help people understand what the needs are in the industry and what actually happens inside a game design business.
So it's partly about putting together a business network infrastructure that's capable of responding to the collective demands of the industry in the area?
That's a perfect description, Aaron.
Okay. Thanks. So can you give us a sense of the what the panels, the workshops, and the speakers are going to be about?
Sure. We're going to start with, once the program really gets underway, our first session is going to be a panel of executives from most of the game design or the digital game businesses in the region, not just game design, but businesses that serve game design industry as well. So we'll have folks there from First Playable, from Vicarious Visions, from Valon Studios, from Catapult, from Mad Glory. I don't want to leave the danger of starting to make a list is that you're going to leave someone out of it. Mm-hmm. But pretty much all of the digital game studios in the area will have representation on the panel and talk about just that, who they are, how they grew, what they do, what they need, and how they work.
So from what I've read about the event on the website for it, it says it's going to explore the breadth and depths of the digital games ecosystem in Tech Valley. So you tell us a bit about Capital Region Tech Valley game industry. How big is it and what sort of game companies and development projects does it include?
Well, now that's kind of an interesting question because I think everybody's still trying to get a grasp on really how big it is. I think there's a lot of, there's a lot of awareness of the studios that are out there, but there's not necessarily as strong an awareness of the entrepreneurs, the startups out there that are just digital game designers that are trying to get on their feet, and the support network of companies that have arisen that are contributing to that as well. So putting your finger on exactly how big it is has been difficult. The exciting news that I actually have to share with you is that we just made an announcement today that Andrew Kennedy, the president of the Center for Economic Growth, is going to join us on Wednesday. And during our welcome, we'll announce the results of a survey of the digital game industry in the region that was designed to actually give us some facts and figures on that that are can really be used to help build support for the industry in the region. So while our incidental information clearly is that it's very strong and that there is a cluster here in Troy, the survey results, I think, are going to be very interesting and probably help us really support that with the actual numbers.
So part of what this is also about as an event is creating that sort of big picture, macro analytical picture of what's the actual state of the industry in Tech Valley.
Absolutely.
Yep. Okay. So do you expect digital games development to be a growing part of the Capital Region economy in the near future?
Definitely. I think it's going to continue to be a growing part of our economy, and including in that gig economy with the freelancers and the whole creative economy thing. It's going to continue to grow. In order to help that on a little bit, we're trying to encourage entrepreneurs in this by providing a breakout, what we're calling them dig down discussions for entrepreneurs, for technical and for creative people in the industry, as well as hearing from Brian Corrigan from Mad Glory, who started a game design business and then grew that successfully and then pivoted into an organization that actually supports game design businesses. Mm. So he's really going to give us a demonstration or talk to us about how there's more to it than just the design part. There's a lot more to the industry than just game design.
So if you're someone with game design skills listening to this right now, what can you get out of coming to this event?
Well, one thing that you can get out of it, I'm sure, is connections and an idea of where you might make additional connections in the industry. At the conclusion of the event, we're having a networking session where all of those studios will have tables, as well as our sponsors, who are the Center for Economic Growth, HRFM and Innovate 518, which is the regional hotspot in the area, as well as the city of Troy. And they'll have tables of and the International Game Designers Association and the Tech Valley Game Space will have tables during the networking reception where folks can speak to representatives one-on-one. So they can talk to people from the studios, make connections there, learn a little bit more and about what possibilities there are to work there.
Sounds great. So if people want to go, how can they get tickets?
They can get tickets through our Facebook event, which is part of, can be found on the Tech Valley Center of Gravity Facebook page, or they can Google the business of game design. I'm sure it will come up, or go to Eventbrite, but there's a link, bit.ly/bizofdigitalgames. We'll get them to the registration. It is free, but we're encouraging people to register for it in advance because if they register in advance with a $10 donation to the Children's Hospital at Albany Medical Center, they also will get a free parking pass.
Oh, I see. I saw the $10 on the website, and I figured that there was actually an admittance cost, yep. But that's just the optional donation.
It's an optional donation that will get that will ensure them a seat and get them a parking pass.
I see. So registering is a good idea, and mm-hmm. donate if you want.
But certainly we will take walk-ins. It's at 33rd Street on the corner of Broadway and 3rd Street in downtown Troy. But we do expect that it may fill up. So advanced registration is a good idea.
Well, thanks again for this interview, Holly. Very best of luck to you with your upcoming event. And to the members of our listening audience, tune in at the same time next week for another interview with Holly about Tech Valley Center of Gravity and what it's all about.
If you're just tuning in, that was Holly Cargill Kramer, the director of Tech Valley Center of Gravity. If you are liking our show, let us know. Send us a text at 518-888-3004. That's 518-888-3004. 3004.
Next, WOOC correspondent Masha Miller met with Samuel Yeager of Living Resources to talk about life with disabilities.
Hi, this is Masha Miller, WOOC, coming from upstate Troy, New York. I, Masha Miller, will be interviewing Samuel Yeager. Samuel Yeager, what do you do for a living?
I do a few things, actually. As a community rehabilitation instructor and counselor for adults with developmental disabilities and brain injuries.
What agency do you work for?
I work for an agency that's a nonprofit organization, as I mentioned, called Living Resources. And we support individuals with developmental disabilities and acquired mental disabilities like brain injuries, like from which I am a recovering currently 4.5 years or so.
What brought you to working in this field or career?
That's a really good question. And I never question it myself. I'm never like, why am I doing this? You know, I don't feel like my work is work. You know, I feel the truth, the reality of it being fun and rewarding. No credit of my own, you know, my recovery has been so miraculous and I've had so much support. So I think that this is a place I've wanted to work for a long time. I want to be able to repay what was so freely given to me to be able to recover and have a great life, an even better life because of my disability.
How do you feel about the word disability?
That's also a really good question. I think with everyone's disability, whether it's being on the autism spectrum or having a brain injury, with the parts that are afflicted of your mind or your neurological brain or your psychological existence, you know, I think that there are a lot of benefits that come too. I think when you take something away, things are added too. You know, I think that I don't think it should be called disability. I use that word. I don't really, you know, I know that you and I, Masha, both have disabilities, as it's called. But I think that we both have a lot of qualities that most able-bodied or able-brained people properties and qualities that they don't have.
One, what is your disability? Two, how did it happen?
Again, really good question. My disability is, it's so funny, now that you mentioned how I feel about the word disability, it sounds funny to say it. My different ability is, I have survived a severe traumatic brain injury. I was in a coma for 5 weeks, had brain surgery, needed to relearn how to do everything. So I've had 4 years to relearn all my basic and advanced human skills, I guess you could say.
Life skills.
Yeah. And part of the side effects of, my disability, and not to complain, but just to educate, I suppose, is, I have a seizure disorder from my brain injury. I have a post-traumatic stress disorder.
What's been the hardest part about recovery?
It's funny when you say recovery, I have a couple different kinds of recovery. Well, there's the recovery from my brain injury, which was my accident. My fall occurred. I was...
Can you tell the whole story about...
Yeah. Since I was 19 until about a decade later, 29, I had, and this is part of my story of recovery, I am an alcoholic and drug addict who's in recovery now. I have over a year and a half sober, one day at a time. But you can, having said that, you can imagine what I was doing the night I had my accident. I was drinking a gratuitous amount of alcohol, and I'm proud to say that I'm in recovery, and I hope to be an ambassador. And if people are out there listening to this and are struggling with substance abuse, there is a solution. And to, you know, Google it, Google 12-step recovery-based programs. Or my drinking caused me some pretty severe reckless abandon, and I was drinking a lot for the worst part of a year, I would say, you know, getting gratuitously what we call in AA, we call overdosing on alcohol, also known as getting drunk. I was very, very drunk, was riding my fixed gear brakeless bike, which I normally rode a lot. I rode, when I lived in Boston, I rode about 20 miles a day. I was definitely not sober for all of those. And biking while drinking is just as, if not more, dangerous to yourself than driving while drinking, or, you know, driving while impaired. And it can be life-threatening, and most head injuries, even less intense than mine, result in death. It's really pretty crazy that I survived. But I had fallen around 4 a.m. and hit my head on the sidewalk, I believe.
Does anybody know this for sure?
Well, there was no damage to my bike. So I hit my head somehow hard.
What was the cause of your injury?
I would say mostly it wasn't the cycling. It was not wearing a helmet. It's extremely important every time one rides a bike to wear a helmet, because you can't
control. Especially kids out there.
Especially kids, yes. Especially, well, you know, kids are the most important people we have on this planet. You know, not that anyone's more important than others, but kids have the most potential to do the most harm or the most good. So I fell somehow because of intoxication, poor balance, and such. And then I hit my head really hard. My brain was bleeding. I had hemorrhaging inside my skull to the point where they had to put me in a medically induced coma and in a vegetative state, you know, and drill a hole, give me a craniotomy, brain surgery, drill a hole in my skull to alleviate the blood, to let it come out, because the pressure was too high. It was going to kill me. I was very, very close to dying. And actually what did die a couple times, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you know, did have a measurable lack of life for a second there.
How long were you in the coma for?
I was in the coma for, see, it's tricky. I was in the ICU in Albany Med in a vegetative state for a month. And then I believe when I got brought out of there, they took me off the medically induced coma meds, you know, the medicine they give you to put one in a coma. They brought me to Sunnyview Rehabilitation Hospital in Schenectady, and I was in a coma, a common misconception about a coma is that you wake right up.
What was the best part of the whole process of recovery?
the best part of the whole process of recovery. I guess the present moment, you know, it's getting to be here. It's getting to use the trauma of my experience as the oil in the gears of someone else's recovery, or at least acceptance, if they're not in a position where they can recover, you know, acceptance, radical acceptance to accept where they're at in their, you know, quote unquote disability. I feel like one of the strengths of mine at Living Resources is I help improve just from talking with people and sharing and listening. I can kind of help improve people's acceptance, you know, noticeably in a tangible way, where someone will go from feeling victimized to agreeing with me when I say, and I'm not looking for anyone to agree with me, but when I say my accident, my brain injury is, you know, certainly the worst thing that's ever happened to me, but also the best thing that's ever happened to me, because now every day I get to wake up, breathe on my own, walk and talk on my own is a great day. And that's my baseline. So I guess that's probably my favorite. That's the best thing it's kind of like when, you know, when you go through, like we're right now, we're going through a long, cold winter. You get, that makes you appreciate the contrast. That makes you appreciate the spring and summer so much more. That was the winter of my life, you know, the real, real dark times in recovery. And now, and that I have had this miraculous recovery, I just am kind of basking in the sunlight of the spring and summer, metaphorically.
What advice would you give someone who is going through what you went through?
So probably very, very important is meditation, you know, any mindfulness exercises. And meditation is just having quiet time to clear your mind.
Any other suggestions, ideas?
Yeah, I'd say it's
meditation, Ron.
Meditation, and these are in no specific order, because probably number one would be really, really, really try to avoid or abstain or eliminate from self-harm, especially if you've had a brain injury. Things like, you know, hard drugs, any mind-altering substances, specifically, I'm including alcohol as a hard drug. I've done a lot of drugs in my time, and drugs are pretty much the really good purpose of drugs is to let you know that you don't need them, that your brain makes everything you need, and that you get to feel good all the time. You don't have to try to feel good. You can just choose. When you're feeling happy, you can find that light switch. Leave a string or a trail to the switch, and then remember what it's like. Have a place marker, and then remember just to flip that switch. Be like, oh, this is what I felt like when I was so happy. And you feel it first. You think about it, and you feel it first. And then it just kind of happens. And a big part of it is trust, a.k.a. faith.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Masha.
Samuel, this is Marshmallow, WOOC, Troy, New York.
That was Masha Miller interviewing Samuel Yeager of Living Resources. And now we are in the studio with Stanley Hatzel from Market Block Books.
I like that extra S there.
Yeah.
How are you doing, Stanley?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Glad to have you. So what books do you have for us today?
Well, I brought some really cool books. The first one is called An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. This is a signed copy, by the way.
Ooh, fancy.
This book, before it was released, was chosen by Oprah to be the next Oprah Book Club. So it was like big top secret until the book was released. And she has a really cute story about the day Oprah called her when she was driving in her car. But she was actually trying to write a novel about mass incarcerations in the United States. And she was really struggling with that. And she eventually settled on this couple in Atlanta, Celestial and Roy, African-American couple, you know, bright, young, intelligent. He went to Morehouse, and I think she went to Spelman, maybe. I think that's the college.
They are both really cool HBCUs. They've been around for a really, really long time. And they're also, Morehouse is like a all-boys school, and Spelman is an all-girls school.
Right.
And I think they're like right down the street from each other or something like that.
Yeah, I got that sense. So it ends up, they get married, and after, I think, 18 months after they're married, he gets arrested and charged with rape and sent off to prison for 12 years. in wrongly arrested and wrongly accused, and then this becomes this tension between the two of them and their relationship, trying to have this marriage, this brand new marriage, by letter. And a few things, I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but a few things happen where she's an artist and she becomes even more popular on her own without her husband. And then he eventually gets released early, and there is a struggle about how do we reconnect after this five-year gap. So of course it's about the wrongful imprisonment, but she doesn't really focus on prison as part of the story. It's more about this relationship and how that becomes a mirror for all the other issues in society.
That's really, really cool.
And it's powerful. It's just a powerful book, and because the topic is a difficult topic. I mean, we really are messing up the lives of so many people, especially African-American men in this country. So she's this is a brave novel.
Definitely.
Tayara Jones is her name. An American Marriage. So I wanted to follow up with something a little bit more joyful. And last month, the American Library Association announced all the children's book awards, and the Coretta Scott King Award went to somebody else. But this book I'm bringing here is one of the honors. It's called Crown, An Ode to the Fresh Cut, written by Derek Jones and illustrated by Gordon C. James. And you have to look at this. It's such a festive and delightful and celebratory book.
Oh, I love the artwork in here.
So it's about this young man who is going to get his haircut. He's African American, and he's going to get a haircut. And the text describes the joy about it, the little details that if you've ever been sat in a barber's chair, you remember those little details. It should have won an award. I mean, it got the honor, so that's very nice. But I think it could easily have taken the first prize.
This is very cute.
It is very cute.
Yeah, just to describe the artwork, it's like it looks to me like oil paintings.
It does.
Yeah.
Really expressive.
And very vibrant. Yeah. Nice, vibrant backgrounds.
What else you got for us, Stanley?
So the next one is Automating Inequality, and the subtitle is How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. This is by Virginia Eubanks, who is a Troy resident, and this is her second book. This is about, as the title pretty much explains, how we are doing more and more awful things to the poor. So really, the poor in our country, it just keeps getting poorer and poorer, and the gap between the rich and the poor is widening more and more. It is not an upbeat book. It's a necessary book because we're moving along at such a clip with technology, but we don't understand how that is locking people out. And if you don't have that technology, you can't afford that technology, then how do you tap into the resources so you can access what you need for services, which, of course, is one of the issues she talks about, is that's a way of defunding programs by locking people out technologically.
I'm excited you brought this one because I'm reading it right now, and I hope to soon have Virginia Eubanks as a guest on my Data Justice series. So,
She'd be perfect for that. So I encourage you to read it. Her earlier book was called Digital Dead End, which again similarly talks about how the availability of technology is just not there for people who don't have the resources.
I think my copy is actually waiting for me at Market Block Books. I'm supposed to pick it up.
I think it might be, yes. You can ask for a special hand delivery if you like. I want to squeeze in a couple of fun books. This is World History 101, and I get annoyed with history books that only focus on European history. So this one is a little bit more expansive, and they do mention that... actually, they reference an ancient Greek who says that the beginnings of humanity are in Ethiopia, and then this book says, and that's true. That's where it's been proven that humanity started in Ethiopia. So I love that little bit about it. But it covers India, or the origins, some of the origins of India, which is actually more complicated than we imagine, and mm-hmm. and China and Japan, and so it's not just focusing on Europe and Western. A fast blurb, because I'm a word nerd. This is called Word by Word by Corey Stamper, K-O-R-Y, Corey Stamper. She has a blog, coreystamper.com, and she talks about words. So this is about how you sculpt, how you make, how you create a dictionary, and all the processes that go into making it. And if you look at page 52, there's a chapter on the word irregardless, which is one of those words that always made me crazy. And she as well. And it's a funny bit about how she's, no one would put that in a dictionary. And then without her knowing it, they had put it in. She works for Merriam-Webster.
Oh.
So she works for the big guys.
They have a really snarky Twitter handle.
Do they?
That's great. Yeah.
I have this book called Montaigne and Barn Boots. Michael Perry wrote this. He lives in a small town in Wisconsin. He used to drive an ambulance. He's written a bunch of books about small town life. And this is him about learning how to be a philosopher while he's running a farm. And I wanted to read this little blurb here. It's called Reading Like a Chicken. Have you ever dumped a pail of chicken scraps into a chicken pen? When I did so this morning, there was an eruption of flapping, squawking, and pecking, every chicken for itself, barging and gorging. These are pigs with feathers. For all their determination, they lack focus. Two or three frantic pecks here, and suddenly the bird is seized with an idea that is really good stuff is over there, and claws and cackles its way by frenetic zigzagging through. And that's how he's describing how he's reading philosophy, like a chicken, just zigzagging back and forth.
Adorable. Well.
He's a charming guy. He's got a great sense of humor and a good read. And this is my personal signed copy.
It seems like it's a good read. Well, we are at the end of our show, very, very end of our show. So that concludes our show. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Tatiana Morani.
And I'm Dan Pfeiffer. Remember to tune in back tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
Thanks for tuning in.